publicists love your work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative entrepreneur, find your unique voice, find the right mindset to succeed, be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living making your art. I'm David Cadavy. If you want to join us here and love your work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And to get your free creative productivity toolkit, sign up at cadavy.net/tools. To me, Andrew Warner's Mixergy podcast created the entire category of entrepreneur interview podcasts, a category that this here podcast falls within. I started listening to Mixergy something like 10 years ago, and it was one of the main podcasts that got my gears turning to eventually start this podcast, after I put it off for many years, of course. Andrew has created over 1,700 interviews and courses with top entrepreneurs, people like Jimmy Wales, Barbara Corcoran, and Paul Graham. He's known for getting his guests to open up and to reveal exact numbers in their businesses. Actually, sometimes I find myself squirming at the direct questions that he asks, but it works. I recently took a trip to San Francisco to be on the Jordan Harbinger show. Look out for my appearance on that show toward the end of March. I think you're really going to like what I prepared specifically for that show. But while I was in San Francisco, I was trying to think of who I would like to interview. And the first person who came to mind was Andrew Warner. And honestly, I was a little reluctant to interview him for the show because I wasn't sure if he was a great fit, because on his show, they often talk about numbers a lot. It's very much about how much money did this entrepreneur make. And if you've listened to this show, you know that it's not very much like that. But after talking to him, I can see why I had that gut feeling that I should interview him, because he loves entrepreneurship so, so much, and it really shows. And so it turned out to be very appropriate, especially the fact that we did this interview on Valentine's Day. So in this conversation, you're going to learn about monetization. Andrew was the first podcaster that I can think of to put his past episodes behind a paywall. Now, why does Andrew think that was such a great decision? What drove that decision? And why does he hate the word paywall? Also, did Andrew create the category of the entrepreneurial interview podcast? I was dying to know who inspired Andrew to interview entrepreneurs in the first place. We're going to find out. And why is harsh criticism a gift? Andrew shares his perspective, which helps him keep improving. Also, the day before the interview, Andrew messaged me. He wanted to change the location of the interview. We were originally going to do it in Mixergy's offices in the financial district in San Francisco, but now Andrew was inviting me to his house. He said that he would explain why later. You're going to hear why in the interview. It's pretty cool. Also, this is the first episode with detailed show notes. I recently put out a call for new patrons to help us reach a new goal, wherein we would be able to afford to get a list of people and places and articles and books and other things mentioned in the episode, along with links to all those resources. And I thought it was going to take a while, but it happened very, very quickly that we reached that goal and surpassed it, in fact. Andrew and I talk about a lot of interesting stuff in this episode, so those resources will come in very handy. Thank you so much to our Patreon supporters for providing these detailed show notes. And if you'd like to help bring this show to thousands of people and put your money where your mind is so you will get more out of Love Your Work and get other bonuses along the way, support on Patreon at patreon.com/cadavy. It means a lot. One of the toughest things about making it as a creative entrepreneur is focusing on the right things, focusing on the things that are going to move the needle. To use David Allen's GTD terminology, we sometimes get distracted by the latest and the loudest. We feel like we're being productive, but we're really trading a dollar for a dime. We're thinking in the short term, we need to be acting now for the benefit of the long term. And I have spent 12 years getting to where I am today, and I'm going to be sharing everything that I've learned about staying self-motivated to be a productive and successful solopreneur in my upcoming webinar, Self-Motivation for Solopreneurs. It is on March 20th, so next week, and it's free. This is a live webinar. You can ask me questions in real time, learn the details, and sign up at cadavy.net/motivation. That is cadavy.net/motivation. Hey, I just wanted to drop a quick note in here at the last minute. I was just looking at my Libsyn stats, and I'm happy to announce that after more than 3 years of doing this show, we just passed the 1 million download mark. Now, some part of me feels like I should make a really huge deal out of this. It's probably because a long time ago, I was aching to have 1 million downloads, but now I don't really feel that way. I certainly mentioned it many times in the past, the number of downloads and how I'd like for us to have more, but I quietly stopped trying to grow the podcast several months ago. I told myself that I was going to stop worrying about what tactics and strategies I could use to get more listeners, and instead I would try to make the show as interesting as possible for myself and for the listeners that I do have. And I also decided to start trying my best to connect with those listeners, those of you who are listening. And the main reason I'm able to do that is because of the wonderful Patreon supporters of the show. So thank you very much to all of them. As long as there are people out there who get enough value out of the show to feel compelled to give back, I'm quite happy with that. 1 million is a nice round number. It has some significance. So I didn't want to let it pass us by without telling you, especially because I had mentioned it so many times in the past. I know many of you feel strongly enough about the show that it means something to you, as it definitely does mean something to me. Just how much, I'm not really sure. Not a ton. I want to focus on continuing to make the show interesting for myself and those of you who are listening. So, okay, wonderful, yay, let's celebrate for a moment. And now, back to work. Thank you. Here's the interview. Andrew, we're in your home.
Yeah, man. It's kind of weird.
But I have to leave in like an hour. You're forcing me out.
Yeah.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, man. So Valentine's Day is Olivia and my anniversary of my first date with Olivia. Yeah. She came to my house on February 13th, 12 years ago. And she played poker because I like to organize a lot of things with friends, and she won. And after she won, she helped me clean up. And I said, do you want to go out for dinner? Actually, I think it was drinks. She said, sure. I said, how about tomorrow? And we went out Valentine's Day. And this is our first Valentine's Day apart. So I'm going to surprise her. I'm going to go grab the kids from school early, put them in the car and drive them out to see her.
Where is she?
She's at a conference for her company. She works at PagerDuty. So since I'm going to PagerDuty, I've got my PagerDuty socks on. They've got some kind of company retreat. They're always doing something. She's always doing something.
Your first date was on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Did you think that's kind of weird?
Up until that year, Valentine's Day meant a lot to me. Usually Valentine's Day meant you're a loser and one day you're going to make it and then you'll be able to date a lot of women or you'll find someone you love, but it's going to work out great. But everyone else is in love right now and everyone else is dating and you're not. And then I started to date and actually enjoy Valentine's Day more than the women I was dating. And then it became a thing that I needed, like to have to do something every Valentine's Day, even if I wasn't with anyone. And the year that Olivia and I met was the first year I was just okay with it. I'm not a loser if I'm not with someone. I'm not like in a perfect situation and okay with myself if I am with someone. It's just, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And I'm okay not being with someone and not defining myself by that. And then we had this really good conversation and I kind of had my eye on her for a while. And so I asked her out and it felt just as comfortable saying, do you want to go out tomorrow as it would have been to not do anything on Valentine's Day.
And retrospectively, has she said anything about her thoughts on the fact that your first date was on Valentine's Day?
She thought that it was a very confident thing to do, to be able to do it. And frankly, to even be able to pull it off, we were living in Los Angeles, to pull off a really good night for Valentine's Day with less than 24 hours notice was, I'm glad that it worked out that way.
Well, was it one of those, yeah, I think a lot of restaurants probably have some sort of Valentine's Day special, like hard to get a reservation.
I lived in New York. I would pay a couple $100 per person to go out for dinner. And then it would be this jammed in experience. It sucked. So we ended up going to the Crescent Hotel, which was a hidden gem back then. Now it's just hidden and it should be. But it was this hidden, beautiful place in Beverly Hills that felt old school Beverly Hills, really elegant, really simple. And there was nobody there, which is probably why it failed and turned into something else. And we were able to sit outside in the warmth of February in LA and talk and have a drink and then go inside. And then we happened to want to have dinner, and there was a restaurant that was open. Actually, they were closing, but they said, sure, sit down. We'll get you what you want to eat. And it was just the two of us in that restaurant. It was a good first date. And yeah, this is our first year apart. And tomorrow she's still going to be at the conference. And so the plan had always been that I was going to go take the kids and do something fun with them. And I thought, I'll just take them out to see her, and that'll be our fun thing, going to whatever in Napa. We'll do something together.
Yeah, that fits within the criteria that you had set out.
Yeah.
Doing something fun with the kids, right?
Actually, yeah. I love spending the day with them. Well, surprise mom tonight, and then she's not going to want to hang out with us tomorrow because she's going to be at the conference. And I'll find stuff for us to do.
Take the kids wine tasting.
Ooh, no, those guys are, they're going to drink too much. you know what? I know we're going to get into business, but I've got to tell you that when my kid was 2 years old, he kept asking to have whiskey because he saw me drink whiskey. You can see this is like a tiny, tiny bit of my whiskey collection. It's pretty big
nice.
Collection. We've kind of been draining this a little bit and not replenishing it. My kid saw me drink whiskey, kept nagging. I said, okay, fine. I'm going to give him a drink, and this is going to turn him off to all whiskey forever. That was what I was thinking. He had a drink, and then he went and had and said, I want more. And I said, no, no. And I thought, maybe it's the ice that watered it down. I gave him alcohol straight, and he drank whiskey neat, and he said, I want more. And I said, never again. So I'm not even kidding with them about wine.
Am I allowed to publish this?
Totally, if it means that I get arrested.
Am I going to get kicked out of Apple Podcasts now?
You probably will. Am I allowed to curse?
We just won't. Yeah, absolutely.
You know what? I'm not even that uptight about all that. I'm worried, like, is David getting the business stuff that he needs? We're now like 5 minutes and 16 seconds into the recording, 18 seconds. I know, think a lot
and
of
we only have like 50 minutes or something.
I could be a little bit late, but I still have deep desires to drive towards goals. The same kind of thing that happened to me with dating. I still have that, and I wonder if I'm ever going to get to a place where I'm just okay.
Yeah. Well, did you ever have, or do you currently have, and maybe you're not even aware of it, I don't know. Is there any elements of this, I guess I can relate to this idea of a Valentine's Day feeling like, oh, you know, it's Valentine's Day, and so if you don't have someone, you're a loser or something. Do you have similar feelings about entrepreneurship or success?
I do. And I wonder when at some point I'll just get to a calm place where it's okay.
And you're not there.
I'm not there for sure.
We're in a beautiful house in San Francisco.
Yes.
You have a podcast where you have an office.
I always want more.
In the financial district of San Francisco for your podcast.
Yeah.
And you're just not satisfied yet.
No. Yeah. I don't know when and if I'll ever be satisfied. And I wonder if it's going to be one of those things like before Olivia, having sex with a lot of women was a big thing for me. And then at some point when I was backpacking through Europe and like kind of thinking it through, I said, let me count how many experiences, how much I've had and see if it's like a good number. And I couldn't count. And I realized it's partially because it been a few women, but largely because I just don't care anymore to count. It's not about numbers. It's about being with them. And there's something that happened that let my head turn from numbers to just being okay. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen to me with work. Will I ever stop caring about numbers and just feel okay? And I feel like when you just feel okay, that's when you can drive better numbers and have better quality everything. I just am not there yet. I don't know what it's going to take.
Is it though? I wonder. Can you drive better numbers when it's just okay?
Olivia would not have wanted to go out with me the next day if all I wanted to do was fuck so I can add another number to my mental count.
Well,
same thing with work. I feel like as long as I'm just like so hounding the work and so hounding the details, I don't think I could be in a good enough place where I can be as good as I'd like to be. But here's one of the things that happens. I do a lot of these podcasts where people come to my podcast and we turn around on me sometimes. And I always go into the stuff I'd like to be better. Like right now, what I'm doing right now. And I always leave people with this impression that I think nothing's ever good enough and that I'm not in a happy place. I'm one of the happiest people you ever met. And so comfortable. Olivia, who knows me better than anyone else, will just be amazed. How could you just be constantly just happy and optimistic about everything? I am. For some reason, whenever I analyze work, it gets into all the rough spots that I wish are better. But I don't want to leave listeners with the impression that that's where my head is. That's just when I analyze it, that's what comes up a lot.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe you just enjoy the pursuit of more.
I do enjoy the pursuit of more, and I do also just feel like it's there's something that's missing and it's not there, and I'm just going to keep hunting for it.
But is there do you feel insecurity there?
No, I'm incredibly secure.
So you don't, you know, if you go to dinner with a friend who has $2 billion and you only have $1 billion, I'm not, I don't know if you have $1 billion, but
I don't, but I've gone out to dinner with people who have hundreds of millions, have lots of like, and it's not just them talking. They won't talk anything. It's if you look them up or if you know them, you see how well they're doing. And it doesn't bring it up so much with them. It's with friends who are a little bit closer, but a little further ahead where it comes up. I go, damn it. Why am I talking to you right now? I should go work.
You feel
harder.
A little
yeah.
Like you've got something to prove still.
Not
when you're talking
them,
to them.
To me, like I'm relaxing a little too much when I'm with them.
You're not concerned about them judging you.
No, I don't think they care.
Okay.
If anything, I actually find that people feel a little bit more, we don't live in a world of braggers. I'm thinking about San Francisco. People aren't braggers. I was talking to you before we started about how everybody here is in tech, in business somehow. And it's kind of interesting and cool, but nobody's bragging about it. People are downplaying it. They're all feeling like, well, there's something else I want to do. I want to keep working on it.
Yeah. Having lived here, I know it is one of these places where you might not discover that somebody's wildly successful until
right
much later.
Right. Right. And they may not be. Yeah, my friend Colin works for NEA, the investment firm, says people come into their office with these beat up old Toyotas and a dream, essentially. And he goes, you won't believe it. Just a few years later, they end up as like superstars of the startup world and everyone wants to be them. And yeah. So one of my challenges doing interviews is to make sure that when we do the interviews on Mixergy, we get the story of the entrepreneur out in a way that doesn't feel threatening, that doesn't feel like you can't get there. They're a step ahead of you and you're never going to catch up. To find a way to make sure that people see the story and get inspired enough to want to be a better version of themselves without being so spooked that they don't want to do anything or that they then start to hate everything. And that's kind of a challenge. I know that's a challenge. I can tell when I talk to people who listen.
And I suppose that's part of why you use this hero's journey format to plan your interviews.
There are a couple of reasons why there are a couple of things that I do. One is I do use the hero's journey. Most entrepreneurs want to come on and tell a story. Most people, even in conversation, if you're asking them about themselves, they either want to totally downplay it, in which case, as a podcaster, you got no story, no reason for anyone to listen, no reason for anyone to aspire. Or they want to just tell you about the good things because they feel like they're here because they've done great things and they want to pump it up. The hero's journey is a format that allows you to have somebody be relatable, then go off on a quest that's so challenging that you care, then fail so that you root for them. Then the story becomes interesting because you relate to them. You can identify and care about their quest. And when they smash their face into the ground, you feel like you want them to do well. And that's the thing I try to do with interviews. And frankly, even when we have conversations, I do dinners all the time. I just interviewed someone yesterday who at the end of the conversation, I said, I really enjoyed talking to you. I know you're in San Francisco. Do you want to come over for poker one time? And Max says, I didn't want to say this in the interview. I was at your house for poker. And that's happened quite a bit where people have been here in the house, never like this for work, but for social events all the time. And I don't realize who it is. What I do know though, is when I have a chance to talk to them, I want them to be relatable. I want their quest to be something that's interesting. I want them to be vulnerable at the dinner table. And I think if we could get to that place, they have these cathartic experiences. And then the people around the table don't feel envious, don't feel disconnected, but feel like they know the person and they're rooting for them. So yes, the hero's journey is a big one. And if you've ever had a dinner with me of four or five people where it's not like out of control, you'll see that I subtly will take people on that path. And then the other thing that I do is I do ask for vulnerabilities, for challenges in a way that allows people to express themselves and keeps me interested too. And so that's been a challenge. How do you get people to do it? And a lot of it is me being open about my challenges. I just spit up on my laptop. I got a little bit excited there. You didn't see it. It was just a tiny bit. But when I get excited, I go for it,
man. I would have not known at all if you just didn't say anything.
I have to. I do like share these vulnerable spots. And then the other thing that I do is I look for hints that they drop of things that they want to talk about and make the conversation a little more interesting, a little more meaningful.
So as we were talking about before this conversation, I feel like you created this whole category of the entrepreneur interview podcast, which is essentially a lot of what my podcast is and what many, many podcasts are, to the point that you'll even hear people say, if you're going to start a podcast, don't even bother starting an interview podcast because it's been done to death. Mm-hmm. Now, take me back to when you were starting that. Were you emulating somebody? Did you create this category?
There was one other person doing it, as far as I know, Gregory Gallant. But I would take the origins of it even before podcasting. This is before any of this. I lived in a world that we're all going back to, a world where entrepreneurs were losers or greedy bastards. Losers in that they couldn't get a job and so they were starting businesses. Greedy bastards in that they were going to try to own everything. Either way, nobody wanted to be like them. They were definitely not cool. We went through a short period where entrepreneurship was cool. Today, nobody wants to be Kevin Systrom. They want to be whatever latest guy is or woman is who's got a million followers on Instagram. They don't want to create the next Instagram like Kevin Systrom did. What they want to do is be celebrities somehow. And we're back to that world where the thing to aspire to is popularity and a celebrity level without creation through entrepreneurship. And I have no issue with any one of these people being popular on Instagram or anyone aspiring to be a basketball player. I don't think there's anything wrong with any of that. I think it's a shame that we do not encourage entrepreneurs, that we do not allow them to be themselves from an early age and support them as a country and support them as teachers and support them as a world enough. So I just interviewed someone else yesterday who told me that when he was a kid, he sold candy out of his backpack and his teacher said, come on, put it away. He wasn't supposed to do that. How many people have gone through that? How many people who are listening to us right now sold something and they were told not to? So I started Mixergy with the idea that these entrepreneurs who nobody understands should be heroes that other people aspire to be like. Not everybody, not all other people, but some other people should aspire to be like them. And that's the point. And I said, how do I do it? And I started out with interviews and I meant to go beyond interviews and I didn't, but we will. The idea of Mixergy is entrepreneurs are heroes. There are a handful of these weirdos out there in the world who want to be entrepreneurs, who need to see people do it right, who need to see that there's someone who made it in the world like they aspire to, who told the teacher, fuck off, I'm going to sell my candy in school, who told the teacher, this is the thing that I want to do. And they did it. And so that's what we want to go to, that kind of environment.
So, but when you did start it, there was intention to this?
Yes, there was. This was like a thing where I was going to start. The very first few interviews were just me kind of saying, I'm doing these events. People should meet the people who come to my events. But these events should somehow lead to entrepreneurship. And the events never went to entrepreneurship. They were just never anything more than social events. But the interviews, highlighting the entrepreneurs who were coming to the events, were about something. They were about something that touched me, that meant something to me from the time I was a kid. And it was finally able to be expressed. And I remember interviewing this woman, Rosalind Resnick, who I did a lot of business with. She bought a big part of my business. Not like a percentage of the business, but she bought outright a big part of my business. And I'd known her for years because she sent me a lot of checks and we talked to each other about our aspirations and all that. And it wasn't until I interviewed her that I fully understood her. It wasn't until I said over an hour, I want to just learn how you got here, that I really got to know her. And when that hour was over, Olivia and I were maybe living together at the time. Maybe she just happened to be over. And I remember saying to Olivia, I found the thing I want to do for the rest of my life. And that was it. It was doing interviews, talking to entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses, crafting their stories, getting to a point where I got to know them better. And then an audience of other entrepreneurs got to know them better.
So when you were starting, was it then events and interviews?
If you want to go to like the wacky thing that I thought of, here's what happened. So I sold my previous company and I had a bunch of time off to do nothing, to literally just walk on the beach in Venice Beach. So there was a boardwalk. It wasn't like my feet were in the sand, unfortunately. It was just like just casual walk on the beach. I remember watching this dude after being in such a high pressure environment myself, watching this guy who was selling trinkets on Venice Beach boardwalk and he was asleep. Just the happiest, most easygoing sleep you could imagine. And I realized that I still was not at a place where if I had to sell, I could comfortably do anything. If I was standing behind that table, I would be hawking the hell out of everything that was there. And I couldn't understand how he could get to that comfortable spot. And I knew I don't want to be there, but I do need to be a little bit more chill. That if I'm still getting anxiety that he's so relaxed, but also aspirational towards that, I think there's something for me to learn out of this experience. So I was spending a lot of time on the beach having those kinds of revelations. And then I started to slowly drift back into entrepreneurship. And I did things like post on Craigslist, if anyone needs help, let's get together at this place and we'll talk. And at the time, I really liked King's Head Bar. And so that's where I would meet people. But I wasn't super helpful. And it was like a lot of to-do to go there. So then I started slowly saying, I'll do calls on the phone with people and help them out. And then I would like pay to give people coaching from other people if they needed it. And I could see I was inching towards something. Then I went and backpacked through Europe. And when I came back, I said, okay, I'm ready to do something. And that thing became events with the idea that people would meet each other. There'd be events all over the world. And then that would turn into this big event movement thing. It wasn't. It ended up being podcast.
So that's where the name Mixergy came from.
Yeah, mixers with energy. Yeah, man.
So then how did you end up doing an interview?
I had some piece of garbage mic around the house. I didn't realize that mics were different. I just thought if you have a mic, you can plug it in. I plugged it in and I used Skype and I just recorded the person. And that was it. And there was a hum. If you listen to that very first interview in the first batch, you can hear a hum the whole time. It was because the mic was just one of those old fashioned mics. The ones, you know, that auxiliary cable type of thing that the headphones used to be until Apple killed the headphone jack. The mic had one of those things. And I realized that's a problem. And then I eventually bought a USB mic and then adjusted a little at a time.
What made you think to even do an interview?
I think there was a part of me that just admired Howard Stern growing up. And I listened to him all the time. And I thought he's doing just having conversations and it's pretty interesting. And I think that when he asks people about some whacked out stuff that I don't care about, I'm less engaged sometimes than when he just talks to someone about how much money they made when they were in television and how they gave away all these rights to their old broadcasts and back then it wasn't worth anything. And then repeats came on and suddenly all the rights that they sold and gave away now are valuable and they missed out. And I just get so riled up about that. Like so interesting, so fascinating. Tell me more. And so doing interviews gave me a combination of the Howard Stern interview and the caring about business. Just full on business. In fact, in the early interviews, you'd hear people say things like, I started my company, then I built it up to $1 million. And once we got to $100 million, I decided it was time to sell. And then I go, wait, stop. It's like a Howard Stern interview. Now, Howard Stern, when you tell him that you had sex with someone, he says, hang on, slowly tell me how you took off your clothes. And then tell me like what the next thing was. I want you to like walk me through that because that gets me excited. Your business, I mean, gets me as excited as that. Do that. And so that was a clear influence. But so was NPR. There was actually just one. It was This American Life. In the early episodes, I was introing just like the guy from This American Life, Ira Glass. It would be, hi, I'm Andrew Warner. You might be wondering about this next guest and how it was kind of a put on. But the clear point has always been there, which is the goal of Mixergy from the beginning has been encourage entrepreneurs by showing them what works for real entrepreneurs. It's got to be that. It cannot be like the Tony Robbins thing that I signed up for, where I paid him and or his company for a coach, and the coach had never been in business. She was just someone who took a class, and that was it. It cannot be that. It's got to be real entrepreneurs passing on to real entrepreneurs, which is why when there's an author who's dissected all these entrepreneurs and can come in and talk to me about it, I think, great for you. Pat on the back. It's not for me. I can't do this. Because, sorry, the fake entrepreneur, like lessony, self-helpy books that I read growing up and that still are published to this day are also happy-go-lucky. Nobody's ever screwing anyone over in those books. It's always like the nicer you are, the better you are to other people, the better your life is. Well, good on you. Guess what? That's not the way the business works. That's not the way business works. And you could see it in the evidence now that email comes out, right? YouTube was not two guys saying, hey, it'd be really nice if when we're having dinner and taking pictures and video of ourselves, we can actually post a video online. It was a little bit of them saying, hey, you know what? We can screw over the major television networks. And if we do that, then we'll be too big for them to ever take us down. Now, look, am I saying that's the way you should be? No, I'm saying I want to know how it is. I don't want to come into a conversation saying, how should it be? I want to know how actually is it? And let me make my decision. Let the listener make their decision. Let us really hear how it is. And you still don't get that from other people, except for real entrepreneurs.
Because they've actually dealt with the competitive environment that being an entrepreneur is.
Yes. And they're not, the world might make them want to be ashamed, but they're not. It's like, so we live in, I'm in San Francisco right now, right? You'll see pictures of guys used to go to gay bars back in the day when gay bar was a thing. And they knew that they wanted to be gay and that they believed that there was nothing wrong with it. And they just had their heads up and proud, and they were going in there even when the world told them no. They just couldn't help but be proud of it. Now, look, I don't know anything about that, but I do know this. I've seen that look in the entrepreneurs who I've interviewed. The entrepreneur look that says, I know that that spamming is not a good thing, but I have to tell you, that's what I did. I spammed to get started. And I'm thinking about specifically Matt from Automattic, from WordPress. If you go back to his interview with me, he probably shouldn't have said, let alone bragged, that to get people to know that WordPress was a good publishing platform for the internet, he would go and spam other people's blogs. But he can't help it, because he knows that's what it took and that it's not hurting anyone, and he's kind of proud. And I feel like that thing comes out from entrepreneurs when you give them a real space to be themselves.
I'm still trying to figure out the very first interview, what motivated you to do that? And were there other podcasts that you were listening to? Did you know it was going to be a podcast, your very first interview?
No, it wasn't a podcast. There was Gregory Gallant went on to create the Shorty Awards. Gregory Gallant is kind of a warning story for me and was an aspirational like thing, an example of what I could do. What he did was he would interview people. I still sometimes in my head will hear his voice when I run, because he had this funny way of saying company. He would always go, and now I'm going to talk to him about his company and how he built his company. But man, he was so sincere.
And was this good. A podcast?
It was a podcast. I met him at a podcast convention in Vegas. He had this giant pimple on his nose that couldn't explode fully, but kind of had. And I loved him for every bit of that. He was like a nerd caring about the nerdiest piece of technology, which was podcasting, back before the iPhone, who genuinely cared about his guests, who didn't talk over his guests and was really interested in them, genuinely interested. So that's what I liked. They said, hey, wait, this is a thing that could happen. And I even interviewed him to learn how he did it. The part that's a warning for me was he never fully monetized it well enough. And so
there are these great gems that were on his site that disappeared because the site wasn't monetized. And I refuse to let that happen to Mixergy. I believe that Mixergy needs to be something that earns enough money that it could survive forever, outlive me. That when years from now, we are implanting chips in people's brains and we're putting in the Library of Alexandria equivalent at the time, Mixergy needs to be in that. You need to absorb all these entrepreneurs in the way you're thinking if you want to be an entrepreneur and take it with you. And unfortunately, he had Reid Hoffman from LinkedIn explaining who the LinkedIn audience was with such a clear understanding. He had Alexis Ohanian on from Reddit talk about how they sold Reddit at a time when this Reddit sale was this, like, my dad would say in Persian, chosaguz, a bird shit. Like little tiny thing. It was like they didn't sell for millions of dollars. They did. They didn't sell for hundreds of millions of dollars. Nobody took it seriously. They were second rate to dig. But you can hear in Alexis Ohanian's conversation about the business and his caring about the interview and his caring about Gregory Gallant. Who the hell was Gregory Gallant? Nobody. To me, he was, because I was listening to him. To Alexis, he wasn't necessarily, but Alexis Ohanian took that care in that interview in a way that showed who he was. And told about his story in a way that, like, you see how easy entrepreneurship can be without making it perfectly easy. Anyway, all that's where I was thinking.
So all of that is gone now?
It is. The links are dead. It's been years since I've even gone to look at his website, but they're gone.
We're going to take a quick break. We've got University of California, Irvine's Division of Continuing Education sponsoring the show. UC Irvine is ranked in the top 10 of U.S. public universities. Their Division of Continuing Education has been offering education to adult learners in Orange County since 1962. But you don't have to be in Orange County, silly, to get educated at UCI, because they provide online courses. They offer flexibility and a real immersive online classroom experience because you get to collaborate with your peers. There's a ton of certificate programs and specialized studies programs available. Whatever you want to study, you can do it on your own time. You can advance your career in as little as 6 months, which is not very long. UCI's Division of Continuing Education wants you to know that spring quarter's coming up. Registration's open. Visit ce.uci.edu/podcast. Enter the promo code podcast for 15% off one course. That's ce.uci.edu/podcast. Enter the word podcast for 15% off one course. This offer is valid through March 31st. You better act fast. When you're building your business around your creativity, you need to be prepared for anything, because the things you create are your bread and butter. And that is why I back up my data with Backblaze. Backblaze offers gimmick-free, unlimited cloud backup for Macs and PCs, and it's just $6 per month per computer. Backblaze backs up everything: documents, music, photos, videos, projects. Everything. You can access your data from anywhere in the world on the web or with the Backblaze app. You can even do what's called restore by mail, and Backblaze will send you overnight via FedEx a hard drive or flash drive with all of your data on it, and then you can keep the drive or you can send it back for a full refund. Make sure you use Backblaze's special URL just for Love Your Work listeners. It's at backblaze.com/loveyourwork. That way they'll know where you came from. They will continue to support the show. I can continue doing the show. Get a fully featured 15-day, no-risk free trial at backblaze.com/loveyourwork. Check it out and start protecting yourself from potential bad times. Start today. And so I think you were probably one of the first podcasters I can think of that put stuff behind a paywall.
Yeah.
And so you're thinking with that, is that the money is food, air, and water for...
Yes. It's more than that. I actually do believe that the thing that's going to keep Mixergy from ending up like Gregory Gallant's stuff is that we charge, that there's money there, that there's like an infrastructure that supports it. I think there's also this care that I have in this thing being part of universal entrepreneurship on understanding. And it may not be valued that way by other people or enough other people now, but that's the way I confront it every time that I go in there. This is going to be the encyclopedia of entrepreneurship in this stage of the world. And I'm going to get to as much depth as I can to get there. So that's a big part of it. The other reason why I charged was nobody cared about the last stuff. So let me tell you something that happened. I used to go to everything, every kind of event, Kiwanis clubs, Rotary Club. You got a club, like if you had a cult, I literally would go into your cult and I would be there and I would pray with you in the cult because I just wanted to see how organizations worked and what happened. There's something that happens almost universally at all these things. Learning Annex is where I saw it best. People would pay for these stupid Learning Annex classes and the first row was empty because it's kind of weird to sit next to the instructor, right? The second row was kind of empty. And then when you went to the back row, it was packed. And I compared it to events that I'd gone to where they charge extra for VIP seating in the front. Now people care because they paid extra. They care about it. Because it's VIP, we all look at the people who are there. Because VIP, we aspire to sit closer to the instructor, not all the way in the back. Makes for a much warmer feeling for everyone. When you're somebody in the back and you see two rows empty, one fully empty, the other nearly empty, it looks kind of weirdo to you. But if you see people who are proud in the front, suddenly this thing that was garbage at every other event, the events that charge VIP seating for it, that charge more for those seats, made it more valuable. So what does that have to do with my podcast? The older episodes are the most undervalued episodes of any podcast. There's always going to be somebody who's going to scroll through and listen to an older episode here and there. But once you get past 100, who's going to go and search past 100? Who's going to go search now that I'm past 1500, nearing on 2000, maybe I've exceeded, I have no idea. Who's going to go search beyond that? Those older episodes, suddenly nobody cares about. So here's how I make people care about them. I charge. And what charging means is, first of all, anyone who buys is buying into this like Library of Alexandria idea that I have, that this is, you're making this more sustainable for the long term, number one. And number two, you're also getting access to it. But now the fact that I charge means everyone who's going to have an opportunity to listen to my latest episode knows it's going to go behind a paywall in a little bit. I better get it now is the thinking before it goes back there. So now the older ones are more valued to the point where people pay. It all gets sustained. The stuff that nobody cared about, I'm now using to make people care about the whole collection of it. And so 100% that works. And now I think that my money mindset is the only thing that will allow it to be sustainable. Can I go on another rant here? I know I'm kind of taking.
Yeah, please do.
Here's another rant. What's the new podcast app? It's not new. It's been around for a while. That was just acquired by
Anchor?
Spotify. Anchor, yes. So the founder of Anchor goes out there and he says, podcast hosting should be free. It shouldn't cost any money. And I thought, what a lie this guy is telling. Swiffer's business. It's such a lie. And the reason that it's a lie is because you know it's all going to go away. If he's not monetizing enough, it's going to go away. And if you don't pay for it, you know it's going to go away. And here's an example of how it go away. I went back and I said, I don't want to be negative, but since we're in my house and I'm kind of being open with you, I'll tell you. I went back and I said, let's see what happened to all the old Anchor audio that's been on the internet. Like when TechCrunch, you could go do this yourself. Maybe they'll delete it out of embarrassment by the minute after this is published. You go back and you look at the launch of Anchor on TechCrunch. There was an embed code from Anchor on that launch. That thing is dead. It's dead. Because they decided to go from version 1 to version 2. They killed all those old links. They couldn't even say to themselves, you know what? They're people who trusted us in the beginning. Yeah, they didn't pay for anything, but we believe that information needs to be free. We believe hosting should be free because it doesn't cost that much. We're going to go and support the old stuff. Nah, they moved on. They moved on. If there's not a money incentive, it's not going to survive. It's got to have a financial incentive. How's that?
You've got my gears turning now.
What are you thinking? You think you want to charge for the old stuff?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I have thought about it. Well, I've got 170 episodes here,
yep.
You know, that's like 100 hours of content, something like that, which it's quite a bit. It's not a ton.
Hey, when you say that to people, most people feel very overwhelmed by it. Like, oh man, that's too much.
What am I going to do with 100 hours?
Right.
Of content?
Give me 100 hours. I don't need it. Right? It's too much. I've got too much on the internet. I think that we're making a few mistakes here in podcasting. Not we. I'm not making this one mistake. We call it a show. You didn't say a show, but too many people calling it a show. I don't know what we're trying to aspire to be. Are we like playing like Little Rascals where everything's a freaking show? It's not a show. Like if this was a show, it would be so much more entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And if you look at my podcast episodes, if they were shows, they'd be so much more like fun and entertaining. It's not about that. I think that case studies and other verbiage needs to be applied to this and needs to be considered that way. We're not here to put on a show. We're not here to entertain you. Sit your ass down if you care about this and listen to this.
It's education.
It's we need to be thinking more like that. I don't love education because it reminds me of high school and elementary school, which is basically, in college especially, which is basically just a fraud. A lot of it is. But there's something there.
Well, babysitting versus education is what.
Yeah, I just think that it's too connected emotionally and mentally to school, which is mm-hmm. too disconnected from what education really
is. Training.
Yeah, training is a little bit closer. There's something there, but you're right. We need to be thinking of it as that. We're not here to have a conversation. We're not here to put on a show. We're here to arm these people, to give them superpowers. If they're listening to it, they need to have some kind of superpower. Now, it doesn't have to be so heavy-handed that it's like, Andrew's here to give us the 7 steps towards whatever, right? We actually don't learn very well that way. But if there's a story with a clear message in it, the story will make the message go into people's heads and then it'll stick there long after the messenger is even forgotten. And if you do it right, I feel like that has an enormous power. And that then becomes something worthwhile to charge for older episodes. Now look, let's suppose you don't get any money for it. Go look at your data and see what happens 3 months after you publish an interview. You see a lot of traffic and then, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know. When I think about it, a little bit of loss aversion starts to creep in because then I think about like, well, my first episode is with Jason Fried and then I've got this episode with David Allen and like the classic one with Seth Godin and, you know, these episodes that bring people in, or at least I think that they do. They bring in, they certainly get listens. Do those people go on to listen to more episodes? I don't know, but maybe I'm going to miss out.
If they get listens, you can still keep it in your feed.
Yeah.
But check it out and see if they really do get listens. Here's something else that I learned. There are a couple of things that I've learned. Number one, David Cohen told me that you shouldn't, the founder of Techstars, they've invested in tons of phenomenal companies. SendGrid is one that was recently acquired by Twilio, did phenomenally well. They've got a bunch of successful companies. I said to him, how do you know what features to add and which ones to take away? And he said, if you don't know which ones to take away, just take it away and see if people scream. If they scream, you know, they loved it. So that's one possibility. The other one is go look at the numbers and see, is it getting that much love? And if it's not, aren't you upset? And if it's not getting that much love and you are upset, one thing you could do is put it behind a paywall. I don't even like the word paywall. I'm going to go out and have food later today from Arizmendi. I'm going to get pizza. Arizmendi's guy is not going to say all our food here is behind a paywall. It's like, who came up with the freaking word paywall? Yeah. What hippie communist? The fact that I'm charging is not a wall, right? Okay, but fine. Let's go back and put it behind whatever you want, behind a cash register. And then go back to your audience and say, look, this is usually something I charge for. I'm now making it available for 2 weeks. Right now, David Allen, most people don't recognize how important he is, but he's someone who helped organize all these people that, and he helped me here and he helped that way. And he sat down with me and it's a little bit awkward. And I think that awkwardness put him at ease enough to say this other thing. And now you've prized it, the fact that you charge for it. So where did I get that? I talked to Naval Ravikant, the founder of AngelList. And I said, this is where my awkward questions are so freaking helpful. At the time, he was running Angel Hacks, or Venture Hacks, just a blog, a WordPress blog.
I used to go hang out in the Venture Hacks office with
really?
Noah, Naval was invested in. Anyway, we used to work out of that office.
Know that.
Venture Hacks office.
It was like this blog. And I said, dude, you've made it. Like, why are you selling $5 ebooks? What are you talking about with this? And it was kind of awkward. You could see, I like the awkward laughs that people give because I feel like now we're getting to the real. And he said, well, for one thing, when I give it away at conferences for free, now they're giving away this thing like it's an important, like it's an important book that they're giving every one of their attendees. And I thought, huh, if he just had like a freebie downloadable thing on his website with a conference, say, and guess what? If you attend my conference, you're going to get the Venture Hacks free book. Nah, no one's going to care. He prized it. It's a way to mint money in some ways. You charge for something so you could give it away for free and people will appreciate it. The problem is we're just giving too much away for free and people don't appreciate it.
Yeah, and it's definitely going to change. It's one of these things that I think that we're all thinking about. Because there's the tragedy of the commons with this stuff, is that we're afraid that if we don't give it away for free, it's not going to spread. Nobody's going to share it. Fewer people are going to get our message. But that can't last forever. And
I don't know if they're getting the message anyway, because we don't, I just don't think we value it. Anyway, that's my opinion is that I'm totally fine with people thinking that I'm a scumbag for charging for the older episodes.
Do people think you're a scumbag for charging for the older episodes?
Sometimes they do. And then I give them a little bit of insight and they go, holy crap, that's amazing.
Does that happen less now than it used to?
I think that I have gotten to a place where if I do it, people are too embarrassed to talk to me about it, or they doubt themselves instead of questioning me. And what I want is more open conversation about stuff. I really like it. I like when I don't like that we're getting to a place where people just assume that if I've done it, it's right. I love negativity. I was actually going to like couch it. I love negativity. If you could be negative to me about my stuff, and I love it.
It's ironic to love negativity.
Yeah, right. To be so positive about it. This is what Olivia means. Like, there's nothing that gets me down just about. I'm just like so optimistic about everything. I'm so excited about everything. Like, the kids will go screaming. We didn't have any time. And right. I'm like, Olivia, don't you just love that the house is full of like noise and kids, and we're able to have kids? Go, dude, what happened?
Well, I can see why you would love negativity.
For work, I do.
For work, yes. But in personal life, I don't know what the benefit would be.
I'm an optimist. I just love it. I really feel like, well, what if we couldn't have kids? I remember like driving. There used to be this place called Action Park in New York. I loved it. I could see why it shut down. People literally would slide down these concrete things on. It was just like a concrete slide that you could go super fast on, holding on to this stupid go-kart that shouldn't even be allowed on any. I'm not describing it well, but it was awful. It was this go-kart made out of nothing with a stick for a brake, literally a stick for a brake.
I think they have something like that in Colorado.
Do they?
Too, somewhere. Yeah, there's like these chutes, these concrete chutes that you ride down like you're a luger.
Yeah, that's it. Right. So people really would have these like scrapes all over their bodies, and they would show it. And it was, I drove one of their stupid cars, and I bumped into something super hard, and I got slammed right between my legs. And I thought for sure, I'm never going to have a kid. This was when I was like 13. I just started to understand. And so the fact that I could just have a kid now, and it wasn't at all an issue, I've been like hiding it in the back of my head for years and thinking maybe I won't be able to have kids because of this one experience in Action Park. And so now if the kids scream, I go, hey, I was able to pull it off. I do that all the time. If you're okay. Married to that, you go, come on, calm down a little bit.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But at work, I love negativity for a different reason. I want people to give me feedback and to care enough about it that I could then use it to improve. Like, I love when people told me, Andrew, your audio quality stinks. I do remote interviews. You're here doing face-to-face with me. Remote interviews are hard. I love that people kept saying the other guy's audio stinks so much, and that eventually we now have a process. We're buying everyone a mic and sending it to their houses if they allow us to. Buying it and sending it to their houses. I just talked to a founder who has found a way for me to automate that, because it really drives our whole team nuts. Actually, it drives Andrea, my assistant, nuts. Just to hunt down people's addresses, make sure she can send it to them, tell Amazon, yes, it's a legitimate address, by putting in the credit card again. It's like such a pain, but we do it. I wouldn't have done it except somebody criticized it. I wouldn't have toned my enthusiasm for my guest down except somebody criticized it. And usually it's not just one. It's like 20 people who criticize for me to go, oh, wait a minute. I have to get it through my head. I'm being a little too effusive here. I like these entrepreneurs a lot, but nobody wants to see a guy sit there and go, oh my God, you're so great. Calm down. So I love negativity for that reason.
Well, yeah, negative feedback, really. Mm-hmm. I can say that the first few times that I got it, it really, really, I mean, messed me up for days.
Oh, really?
Yeah, maybe my first bad book review on Amazon.
Mm,
yeah,
I could see
for
that.
For days.
Because
probably I was just taking it personally, because you know how it is when you, with our biases, we don't, or maybe you don't know that when somebody criticizes you, you think about all the reasons that they're wrong, right? Instead of thinking to yourself, this is a gift. nobody who's close to me, no friend or family member is going to give me feedback like this.
Right. Yes. And that they even care enough to do it.
And that they care enough to do it.
That
as
they
well.
Care enough to do it. And I am a constantly, I don't do really well with things that have to be great from the start. I do really well with things that I can suck at and improve and improve and improve. And that I need a lot of at bats to keep improving. That's why the podcast goes multiple times a week, so that I could take some feedback and then fix it the next time and fix it the next time and so on. So the fact that I get negative feedback means that I can improve with that. But here's the negative feedback that I don't want to be so perfectly happy-go-lucky. The stuff that does get me is the stuff that's in my head that I'm not even aware of. You know, so what's the stuff related to... You mentioned a book. I hadn't published a book. I tried. And the stuff I think that's in my head related to that could be the issue without noticing. It's not like in my head I go, damn it, you can't write a book. There's something there that keeps me from approaching it, and that's, or from going through it.
Well, yeah, but that was interesting because when I mentioned getting a book review, you instantly understood that. So is there some sort of personal wound there around
no,
books?
I was trying to understand what it was. Like, was it that they hit on something that you really saw that was true and they touched it because of that? Was it because the book was more an expression of you? I was trying to get to know your thoughts better through what triggered you about it.
Hey, look, I'm interviewing here. You here.
No? Yeah, I know. And that's why I backed away.
Wait, but you were saying that you haven't published a book yet. Mm-hmm. And that, wait, why?
You know, I had this thought a while back about what I learned from the interviews, and then I was going to do something with it, but I hadn't. And then it just kind of dragged on and on. And then I thought, well, maybe it's not so important anymore. It's certainly not as important to me as it was back then. So that's it.
Okay. All right. I mean,
no, you're feeling something about it. What?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out. Oh, thank you. I could use the coaching. I'm trying to figure out, like, if there's some sore spot there around books, or maybe it's not that. Maybe it's just that I know that people take books too seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, I now publish, if I write a blog post and it's 5,000 words, I'm going to put it on Kindle too.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
the Kindle is a paid web browser. Because you can go on Amazon and you can search and you can find a book that's called How to Add a Device to Your Kindle Account. Now, why does that book exist? That book exists because people search on Amazon, like, how do I add a device to my Kindle account? And yeah, there's some people who are pissed off. They think, oh, well, this should be free information. And it probably would be free information if they knew how to use Google instead of Amazon. But the point of it is, you know, this guy's charging $3 for this book. It's a paid web browser. I read almost nothing on the internet. I read everything on my Kindle. And so it's all books. And so in a way, you're making it easier for people too.
I see.
You just make it a Kindle.
And you're saying make it less special. You know, it's funny. I was going through the books, my accounting books with our finance guy today. And something stood out for me. There was this $5 revenue. Maybe it was 15 actually. I don't even know, but it was tiny. And it just keeps coming from a company that whose name I can't think of right now. But what they did a while back was say, Andrew, we just got funding from Y Combinator. Will you just help us explore this idea? And I said, sure. And it was, can we take your old interviews and turn them into books? And I said, sure, whatever. I want to support whatever you're doing. And they said, okay, we're going to start with Paul Graham. And I said, okay, you're in Y Combinator. Just like, I'm sure it's fine. It's all in the family. Paul Graham's the founder of Y Combinator. And he was working really deeply in the program at the time. And so they did. Now, they didn't get permission from Paul to do any of this. And Paul was surprised because the formatting was pretty bad. They were just exploring it. But even so, people are still buying that book. It still keeps bringing revenue. And again, for something that I wonder how many people appreciate how much he had in that interview with me that was really meaningful. So you're right. There is a sense of it's a book is so special that you don't want to approach it. And then again, it's not what it doesn't have to be.
It's
that.
Really just yeah. words. People are writing blog posts. Amazon's one of the biggest search engines on the internet. There's millions and millions of people right now at this moment searching for things to read.
I do. And you know what?
They already have their account. They have one click ordering.
Yeah. And I do prefer to read that for some reason that Amazon, I know what it is. The reason that I prefer and I would even pay for it is it's for me, the highlighting. I love reading books and highlighting words and then getting all of the highlights out. I recently paid somebody who works at Airtable to take all of my highlights from every Kindle book and put it in an Airtable table and have each highlight have the author associated with it and the book associated with it and give me a room to tag it. It's just great.
Boy, do I have something for you.
What's that?
Readwise.io.
Let me see what that is. What does that
do? So Readwise takes all your highlights from Kindle, from whatever platform, and it aggregates all of them. So I have 11,000 highlights.
Okay.
I've got them color-coded. I do most of them on Kindle. And then every day, it sends me a few of those highlights via email. And I can review them and I share them on Twitter. And then from there, I see what resonates with people. And you can tag them as well. So you can tag them and search them and everything. So this all exists now.
And so now I can actually get, I can hit a tag and find all the notes associated with that tag. That's what I was looking
for. I would imagine. So I haven't used it for that purpose, but I don't. If there's tags, that must be true.
Right. If there are tags, that must be true. And that's all I was trying to do. I was just trying to get to a place where I found these gray stories in interviews, stories where someone wasn't doing anything super bad, but also was clearly skirting the rules. And I thought, I want to be able to pull those out whenever I need them. If there's ever someone who says, I can't believe this guy on Mixergy did this one bad thing, I want to be able to go back and say, here are five other people who did something, five other people you respect, who you think of as being really ethical and admirable, who did different things that are equally bad, if not worse, and be able to call that up.
And that would be collected from just your natural reading process.
I tend to highlight that.
You highlight. Yeah. Yes. And do you color code? How do you determine?
I just highlight. I highlight super fast.
And then you later tag.
And only when it comes into Airtable. I thought, I'm going to make a project of getting it all into Airtable finally. And then I'll tag it as a way of having access to it in the future. But also while I'm tagging it, I'm reconnecting with those old highlights and thoughts. And I thought that'd be a good thing to do. The challenge I had with Airtable was it doesn't work very well on mobile. And I've switched away from computers for everything except for being in the office. So if I'm working away from the office, I'm on an iPad or an iPhone or a Chromebook. And Airtable doesn't work on iPhones and iPads nearly as well as it does on desktops.
I can't wait to see what your life is like when you have Readwise.
I know. I'm curious about that too. It wouldn't be bad to... I'm paying Airtable now $50 a month to get their highest level. So... And it's not built for this. So I'd like to see that.
This does not cost that much.
No. I also hope I can get it all exported out. That's useful for me.
Yeah, I think you can do that as well. I also can't wait to read your first book.
Me too.
Which now I think I have to force you. You could do this. This is what I usually tell people.
Mm-hmm. Hit me.
Is take 500 words on anything. Open a KDP account, make up a name, and just go through the process of putting a book on Amazon. There's something magical that happens that first moment when you see an Amazon page that you created that looks just like the Amazon page for 4-hour work week or
for the
latest Robert Greene book. You know, it just makes the spark go off.
I like the idea that you're bringing up to me of turning even posts into books only because it feels right with my desire for constant improvement. That I like what bothers me about books is you just put it out there once, and I like something that lets me create badly and then improve it and improve it until it's just so good that I'm I feel like it's gotten into.
And you can iterate. I mean, you can improve a book after it's out as well.
Yeah, that's true too.
I'm currently working on, you know, researching, maybe changing the subtitle of one of my books or the cover. And, you know, it's a whole different world from what we have thought of books as. So anyway, I need to get out of your house.
Yeah. So here's my plan. I'm going to go get the kids from school. I've got to get something for them to eat in the car. We're going to go to Napa where Olivia's conference is. Can I still make it before? I think I can get to Napa in 2 hours. That means before she goes to her next event, she is scheduled at 6 o'clock to have a FaceTime with us for Valentine's Day, like in between her two big events. And so I'm going to say, Olivia, let's FaceTime right now. And we'll FaceTime from the location where she is. And then I know the place because she and I went there on a good getaway once. And so we'll surprise her and then we'll let her go do her thing. And then we'll hide out in her hotel room. And the next day I'll take the kids out to, I'll take them to Napa to do stuff. And to make this work, every time I thought this was going to be easy, something weird would happen. Like school's out for the kids. One of my son's kids' mom said, can I drop my son off with you? I wasn't prepared for a day off. Can you take the afternoons? And Olivia goes, yeah, sure. It's going to be easy. It's easy. They're just 4-year-olds. They're simple to take care of. And then I had to come up with a story for Olivia about that. Then her brother suddenly surprises her and stays in Napa in this place. So I call him up and I go, I think I need the place. And then I get him another hotel room. So now I'm paying to move him to another like nice hotel room in Napa. So he gets away for the day and who knows what, but we're going to pull that off. And then, sorry, David, I'm going to end this with this, like this next exciting thing. I'm going to run a marathon from Texas. Do you know this? Are you the last person on earth?
I was just looking. Yeah.
Oh, good. Because I talk about this now endlessly. I want everybody to know this because I'm so psyched about it. I'm going to go to Texas. I'm going to run 26.2 miles. That's the equivalent of a real marathon, but I'm going to do it on my own from Texas into Mexico. Once I get to Mexico, I got two flights, one that I hope to catch. The other one is a backup, all booked. So I'm going to get there. I'm going to check out this city, and then I'm going to get on an airplane, go to Mexico City, and then I'm going to interview entrepreneurs in Mexico. Those guys would not come to me and do an interview here. Like, or do it remotely. I'm going to go to them. And now I've got two entrepreneurs, which believe me, was harder than getting 100 entrepreneurs on Mixergy from the US. Two entrepreneurs in Mexico City said, yes, I'm going to shoot interviews with them, fly back, and then I'm going to do this in other continents too. That's 2019.
That's awesome. Let me know when you come to South America.
I am going there next. I've got a partner for Chile who's helping me set up interviews over there. And so I was going to do a couple of countries. I'm going to go there, but you're not there. Where are you?
Medellin. Colombia.
So that's where I wanted to go. I was planning. He said to me, Andrew, Colombia has got, we've got really good. I think it was in Bogota. We've got
Rappi.
A couple. Sorry,
Rappi is a big one in Bogota.
No, it was a couple of others who are still doing well, but I never heard of. He said I could hook you up with them, and I thought I'm going to go there, and then I'm going to go to Chile, and then I said, wait a minute, I want to do something right instead of smashing too many things in, and I don't get to experience it. But frankly, Colombia for me is someone who's never been there. Is more interesting. Brazil is more interesting. Even Panama, where I've got a layover, is more interesting than Chile because I've been to Chile. But entrepreneurship in Chile is really interesting. They paid entrepreneurs to come there. They're really working on the ecosystem. I want to know how well it does, and I want to run a marathon there.
Great. Well, we'll keep following you then.
Keep following.
And I'll try to hook you up with some people in Latin America.
I'd love it. And the rest of the world. And if anyone out there is listening and knows how I can get to Antarctica, I'm really working on Antarctica. That one's been really tough, but I want to do 7 marathons, 7 continents, 1 year. Antarctica has got to happen somehow.
You got to figure out how to run on Antarctica.
One marathon that I want to be a part of, but anywhere. I would even, if somebody had a volunteer opportunity there, I would go and volunteer. They're doing measurements of stuff all the time in Antarctica. How's the ice doing? How's the weather doing? Great. I can help you measure the ice, but all I need to do is like for a morning run, maybe I get up at 4 a.m. and I go run back and forth, back and forth, back and forth in front of your building until I hit 26.2 miles on my watch. I do it. I hit it. And then I could come back in and continue to volunteer. I will do it all.
Yeah, are you making a documentary of this?
So my friend Devin Meadows is a videographer. I often put out calls in the podcast. If anyone needs space in San Francisco, I've got a great office. Come hang out over there. So he came and hung out a couple of times. We had lunch. We talked. He said, hey, you're flying. I could shoot video. I go, great, let's do it. I enjoy hanging out with you anyway. So he's coming with me. You should see. He's got good camera gear, but he's also got good taste. He's going to shoot video of this stuff, and we're going to publish it.
Awesome. Can't wait to see it.
All right.
Andrew, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Is Love Your Work helping you find your unique creative voice? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to become the creator and human you want to be? If so, please be a part of making this a special and nourishing and thoughtful show. Support the show on Patreon. You'll be an even bigger part of the show than you already are. If you contribute just a coffee a month, you'll be helping support the hosting and production of Love Your Work. Everyone has some unique creative gift to offer the world. Together, we can give people the tools they need to bring that work into the world. The world will be better off for it. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. This is a different kind of model for supporting the work that you love. The choice is yours. Vote with your dollars, put your money where your mind is, and keep Love Your Work going. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/cadavy. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at patreon.com/cadavy. That's patreon.com/KA, D as in David, A, V as in Victor, Y. And if you can't support the show financially, and you've listened to at least 3 episodes, can you do me a favor? Write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can consider it your donation to help support the show. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsors Roxana Maynard of Agility Alchemist at agilityalchemist.com and Paula Spriggs, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pinkovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.